This week on Writers, Inc.
I'm far more somebody who just needs to throw just an utter trash draft out on the screen. And that I can fix that during edits. That it's okay to sit down at the computer and just vibe with that first draft.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, I'm Christine Daigle.
Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So I am fresh off a photo shoot for the cover of Writer's Digest.
Seriously?
Oh, nice.
That's awesome.
Yeah, we did the interview last week.
Welcome to the club.
Cool. Oh, you did one of those too?
Yeah, well, I was in Writer's Digest. I haven't made the cover yet, so you're one up on me.
You were on the cover of something, indie something or something.
I was, indie author magazine. But this is bigger. That's bigger, J.D. Congratulations.
We did the interview last week. It came out really well. You guys know I was having headphone issues. It actually started with Amy from Writer's Digest. And like, I thought it was her. So she was like messing with all of her cables and trying to fix stuff. So Amy, if you listen to the show, it wasn't you. It was me. It was my cheap $30 headphones from Amazon. problem has now been solved.
Amy, I am ready for the cover if you are listening.
It got me thinking about just photos in general. You know, like I need to come up with a better way to, you know, just do photos on a regular basis. Because I've got like a repository of photos on my website, and I do a lot of press, and we basically just give, you know, everybody a link and tell them, you know, just grab, you know, whatever graphics you want out of this. But I see like the same author photos pop up over and over again. And some of the ones that are there, like I weigh like 20 pounds more than I do now. So my face is all fat, and like, you know, like I need to clean house. But I think I need to get better about, you know, like maybe once every 6 months, go to somebody, you know, like it cost me $1,000 today. I'll probably have 10 to 20 new headshots that I can just kind of throw in there. I feel like that's a worthwhile spend that needs to happen on a fairly regular basis.
I've been generating headshots with ChatGPT.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I can do just about anything. So
how does that work? Do you take something with your phone and then just throw it in there and say, do this or do that?
I uploaded one of my paid headshots so that it was at least a good reference shot. And then I tell it, hey, you know, dress me this way, put me in this place. I kind of experimented. I have one. I was trying to replicate a photo that was taken of me years and years ago in Grand Central Station. So I basically had it replicate that and put my current face on it. So it was, works really well. Just FYI for those who can't afford, you know, headshots.
No, I'm going to look into that because like even the ones that I did today, because we were doing it for a magazine, like the background is fairly bland. There's a lot of shadows and dark colors to give them room to put text. But I could probably grab the image of me and throw it into something like that and use it. You know, I'll have to try that. It's worth exploring for sure.
If you follow me on my Wordslinger podcast on YouTube, like every single one of those thumbnails is an AI generated version of me. So.
I know.
there always seems to be like, I don't know, like AI,
like an
just
uncanny
like,
quality to it.
Yeah, there's just like something to them that like
Kevin's uncanny in real life though.
Well,
so I don't know if
enough.
He has
right.
that problem.
Maybe that's why it works. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like you can always tell when they're AI, even if they're just touched up with AI, but I don't know. Maybe that's just me.
Well, Kevin's lighting always looks good in the AI ones. Like, you know, you know they're AI, but like the lighting is always spot on.
Yeah.
All right. And Kevin, you just finished a book like 10 minutes ago, right?
Yeah, like congratulations. 20 minutes ago. So now it's in edit.
Congrats.
Yeah. This one's been, I started working on this one back in June 2024 and put it aside to work on other things. And now that we've been here and I've had a little more time, I was able to knock it out. I'm excited about this one because it's one of my Alex Kane books, and it's I shared the premise with you, JD, years ago, a couple of years ago now, and you were surprised that I would write something that was outside my regular genre.
Oh, okay.
So
is this the one with the unicorns and fairies?
That's the one. Unicorns, yeah. Fairies. Yeah. So I'll get into. I'm going to be making a big announcement about it later. So I don't want to give away anything just yet. I haven't figured out how I'm going to promote it yet. I want to do something special.
And you just drove your Bronco back from Texas to Pennsylvania, right?
I made it in 2 days, but it was 1,500 miles with me just by myself driving the Broncos. Most blissful time. Like I would do it all over again. I loved the whole trip.
Did you just take highways, or did you take like some of the back roads and stuff to kind of take?
No, this trip I just took highways. I was trying to get back here before the week started, so I had some calls and things. But if I didn't have to get here in 2 days, I would have taken like 4 or 5 days and really taken my time with it. I may do that whole trip again just for the fun of it. Why not? My Bronco's very cool.
Did I tell you I love a road trip. My car broke down. Did I tell you guys about this?
Oh, no. Yeah.
Which car is this? You have a Charger or something like that, right?
A Challenger. I've got a 2012 Challenger. Dodge Challenger, which I love. I barely drive it. It's only got 50 some thousand miles on it. So, cause I don't drive that much. But like I got back from Spain and I parked it there's like a local bus terminal. So I go to the local terminal. I take it's like a luxury coach down to Boston Airport rather than park at Boston Airport. So when I got back, I took the bus back to where my car was, got in my car, start driving home. I got about a mile from my house and my car just stopped like in the middle of the street. Like everything just shut down, like no warning, no nothing. It wouldn't turn over or anything. Turns out in the end the compressor blew. And when the compressor breaks, because it's like it's on the same system or whatever as other stuff, it broke the water pump and like three other things. So they had to dismantle like half the car and put it back together. I finally got it back a couple of days ago. And then I always, every time something like that happens, and it doesn't happen a lot, but like you start second guessing, you're like, I love that car, but like, do I want to get a new car?
But it looks cool.
Because I could.
Challengers look cool.
Yeah, that's the thing. I love this car. It's a 6-speed manual transmission. It's got a huge engine in it, so it's fun to drive. And like when I look at new cars, like there's nothing out there that really, gets me excited about, a car like as much as this one
I
does.
I thought they just like reissued the Challengers. Don't they have them back out again? You have to get a new Challenger.
There are new ones, but they're very difficult to find in a manual transmission. Like I had to get this one in Florida, and then I drove it back from Florida to New England. I decided I like a manual transmission.
Manuals are hard to find in almost anything anymore.
My car can go to manual, but it's not actually, you just push it over.
But it's like that fake manual.
It's like the fake manual.
That doesn't count. No, you need a clutch. You need to, like, I was watching one of the Fast and Furious, like the making ofs, and they showed, like, they don't actually even drive manual transmissions in the movies when they're filming. So, like, they showed Vin Diesel, and his hand goes down, and he just pretended to shift. And, like, they use CGI to put the... They use CGI to put the shifter in later.
That's crazy. No, I loved having a manual transmission, but I haven't had one since I got married because she can't drive manual, and I didn't want us to have a vehicle that she couldn't drive. Yeah. So,
see, my wife has a manual transmission, and I'm pretty sure she wouldn't have married me if I had an automatic. That's how that works in my house. All right, what is in the news?
Well, we got some good ones today. First up, is good taste enough to scout Hollywood's next hit? Author Ariana Reich launched a low-cost literary scouting newsletter called Bosco, aimed at helping Hollywood producers discover overlooked books and unusual IP for film and TV adaptation. Instead of focusing only on buzzy bestsellers, Bosco scouts hidden material like forgotten backlist titles, indie press books, unpublished manuscripts, and even internet stories or forum lore that could become the next breakout adaptation. Reich argues that today's film industry is missing great stories because development teams are overwhelmed and risk averse. So her service is built around curated good taste and strong editorial recommendations rather than algorithms or agency packaging.
This is a really good idea if she can actually get the right people to read it.
Yeah, that's the question. So I was looking at it. It's $55 a month. It's actually in pounds, but works out to $55 a month US to subscribe. Yeah. So I'm like, who's subscribing? I mean,
see, if it were me, like I wouldn't charge because I think half these people, even if they're making a gazillion dollars a year, they're not going to pay a subscription to read a newsletter. If anything, you might want to have some kind of gatekeeper, like they have to prove they're an industry insider to get access or something. But they should get it for free.
I bet that she is giving it to industry people for free and has the subscription price there. Yeah, to keep the looky-loos from coming.
That could
that
be.
Makes
I mean,
sense.
It was in Publishers Weekly, so it has to be, you know, something of note, some kind of note to be in there. So, but I like, that's an interesting idea. JD, get all your properties to her. There you go.
That's what I want to do, yeah.
I've got enough stuff going on. My film agent would probably kill me. He's like, why did you put that in there without my authorization? I was working that over here.
Fair enough.
So,
yeah.
Because you didn't work fast enough, pal. That's why.
He works just fine.
Yeah. All right. Well, this next story is we don't have like a breakdown of notes or anything. So let's just openly talk about this. But it's about the Amazon Prime reading program. And I have not looked at this story or this article or whatever. So you guys are going to have to drive and I will contribute. Sorry about that. But
yeah, no, this was a last minute email that came to you.
It was last second. Yeah.
Last second.
Yeah.
I literally got home from the photo shoot and I was going through the emails that came in and there was one from Amazon Prime Reading. And like, I get these all the time where they ask if you want to include a title in Prime Reading. And I always say no, because they don't pay you. You know, so to me, it just seems pointless. And you know, when I did it in the past, you know, I would see my KDP reads drop, you know, because people are getting it for free over here. Mm-hmm. The sales on the ebook drop because they're getting it for free. So it was never a motivating factor. I mean, they put it in front of a lot of eyeballs, but that, you know, isn't always worthwhile. Mm-hmm. But in this particular one, they're actually willing to pay me to put the book in there. That's the first time I've seen that. And it's just a flat payment. But to me, that kind of changes it. I'm willing to take a flat payment for it to go into Prime Reading to get in front of those eyeballs.
Yeah.
But I haven't seen an actual announcement on this. So I'm guessing that they're just kind of quietly trying it just to see how it plays out.
Yeah. It said they have like a limited number of spots, or I don't know if that's just for the program in general or for the payment.
Yeah. I was going to ask that it's not KDP, right? It's the where you get your choice of Prime readers get to pick one
like
book
a free
for free.
Book
is
a
that
month.
What that
yeah.
is?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're a Prime member, then you get to pick. Is it just one book a month? I don't know how that works, but I know you get a couple emails.
I'm not sure because they send it to me every month because I'm a Prime reader. And confession, I've never picked a book from Prime Reading.
Oh, I pick them fairly frequently, but I don't actually know. Sometimes I think they'll give you like two. I think it just depends on like how long you've been a Prime member and like what books they're featuring.
Yeah.
And then they used to, I don't know if they anymore, but then they used to actually offer you if you wanted to upgrade to a hardcover at a reduced price. I don't know if they do that anymore. They did that for a minute.
That would make sense if that was their strategy to try to get you to
yeah.
buy, you know, because they do that when you buy the Kindle book, they give you like a deal on the audiobook and, you know, things like that. It seems to me like that would be a really good strategy for you to say, hey, if you're enjoying this, you can own the paperback or the hardcover for X dollars.
I wish they would like do that with physical copies and the Kindle because, you know, I love having a physical copy, but, you know, I love reading on my Kindle too. And you know, they're always like, do you want the audiobook? It's like, no, I don't want the audiobook for a discount, but I'd like the Kindle version.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm going to actually do that on my, because I built my direct store and I am eventually, I'm going to be adding in print and other things to that mm-hmm. store. But what I'm going to do is when they buy print, they will also get the ebook. Because
I don't need to get it for free. Just like sometimes, you know, the ebooks can be like $15 still, which is, you know, it's fine if that's the only one you're buying. It's still usually lower than a hardcover. But, you know, if you've already bought the book, then another $15 is a lot. Just, you know, $5, $3.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think this is cool because, I'm wondering if we're going to see different names. Confession
that
number
would be
two.
Nice.
The only reason I don't pick up these Prime Reading books is because I'm like, I've never heard of this book or this author, which is usually why I don't pick them up. But if they were something I was interested in, I would definitely pick it up. So
the Amazon published books, I think.
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah. I think they usually are.
I know. I'm always like, who is Christine Daigle?
Exactly. Oh, I got
Forget
I got Christine Yago today. So I was like, who's that? That's cool. I like what people do with my name. It's fun.
Christine Yago.
Yeah.
I like it. All right. Final story. Retailers lack effective tools to combat AI slop. A new research paper says AI-generated slop books are flooding online bookstores, especially Amazon. Researchers found AI use in ebooks went from almost zero in 2022 to over 60% of new books by 2025, while the overall quality of books dipped. Retailers and distributors are struggling to stop low-quality AI books because AI detectors are still unreliable. Several companies openly admitted they are already using, quote, whitelists and behavioral detection systems instead of just AI detectors. For example, Kobo Books is looking for suspicious patterns like brand new accounts, uploading hundreds of books at once, or repetitive metadata. A major concern is the collateral damage problem, platforms tightening filters so aggressively that legitimate indie authors may accidentally get flagged as spam simply for publishing quickly. That is a problem.
Well, I like that we've got a term now, AI slop.
AI slop.
That seems to have taken.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
it's
that's
a very effective and descriptive term that is 100% accurate.
But it seems to me that anything that would truly be AI slop is pretty easy to spot. It's I'm wondering though, cuz what does that include? That's a little bit subjective too.
Yeah.
So, you know, is it considered AI slop if someone just, you know, used AI to help them write the book? They wrote passages, but they didn't write the whole book. You know, I think it has to be nonsensical in order for it to be slop, is what I'm saying.
Not necessarily nonsensical, but I think like when you can just clearly tell it was written by AI, like, you know, it's just every sentence is like the same, like kind of structure. Like it just, you can, like if you go on social media, you can tell who uses AI in their posts and who doesn't. Like it just, AI sounds like AI. And
here's my controversial stand on that, though. Who cares? If the reader will buy it and the reader reads it and the reader enjoys it, then it doesn't matter.
That's a capitalism argument, right?
That is matter.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter. And the whole idea of competition is kind of nonsense. There's no competition. I know that it takes up a lot of bandwidth there. But there's no problem if the book isn't garbage, if the book isn't like complete nonsense.
The problem is people will buy the books and start reading them and be dissatisfied with them and not maybe realize like, oh, this is AI. They'll just think like, oh, like Kindle Unlimited is just shit now. And so they won't. And so now they'll unsubscribe. So they won't realize. And I think that's the problem.
Here's a very simple question. I'm asking this because I honestly don't know the answer. But does the Amazon algorithm use the rating of the book to, you know, like influence its ranking? Like a book that's got a 4.5-star rating, is that going to rank higher than something that's got a 2-star rating?
I think it does. Yeah.
I believe it does. Like, yeah, it shows it more. Rating is part of the algorithm. I don't think it's all of it. But if you've got a 1-star book, it's not going to show it very much, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if they focus on that, that's going to weed out the good from the bad, whether that's it's AI or human. And, you know, I think that's kind of where they need to go, because they're not going to be able to tell. I mean, the detectors are out there. They're not accurate. They're never going to be accurate. The writing from the AI side is going to get stronger and stronger, as much as I hate to, you know, admit that. We all know it.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, it really comes down to, is this a good story or not? And that's what should really matter.
Yeah, I don't like the AI witch hunting. Like, I don't think that should be going on. We should not be AI witch hunting authors, you know?
I understand it from a business standpoint. So if you're Amazon, and forget that they're the largest company and whatever, just if you're Amazon and all these books are getting uploaded, it's costing them money to host them on their servers. It's costing them money every time somebody downloads it. So if somebody's putting up a ton of books and those books aren't generating revenue, they're basically not paying the rent. So it gets to the point where that number gets excessive and they need to weed that out. So I understand why they want to do that. And, you know, a lot of, I'm sure that was a conversation at Drafted Digital too. You know, like, we're spending all this time, all this money maintaining these titles that don't actually bring in a penny, you know, whereas these other ones are. There needs to be a focus there. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, you know, like, I think both things kind of need to be in place. Nobody should be uploading 100 books a day, you know, so there's some kind of marker that can be placed there. But at the end of the day, it should be the quality of the book that decides whether it gets exposure or not exposure. And
I agree.
I do think that there is something to be said for trying to eliminate the noise, though, because I do think that you get, like, if they don't do something before readers have a chance to like give it a star and it's just out there, and you just expect like, oh, this is just the quality out there now. Like I said, like they'll cancel their membership and now KDP just is nothing. And now actual authors can't use it anymore. So, I do think that they need to do something. I don't know what the answer is, but.
Well, there's different ways to tell.
Wasn't Amazon limiting to 3 uploads a day at some point or something? Like, wasn't that a thing? I thought we talked about that.
That even seems like excessive. Who needs to upload 3 books a day?
Hello. I sometimes upload multiple books in a day.
Not every
just depends
day.
Depends on what I've been working on. Not every day, but it does happen.
Yeah, but would it really put you out that much if it couldn't happen? I mean, like, honestly, like, would it put you out excessively?
What if I was doing a coordinated launch of several novellas tied in with a collection, like I've done in the past?
I can tell you nobody is going to make rules and regulations based on the outliers. It's going to be based on masses. I mean, you know, so there's always an exception.
But the outliers will get caught in the same net.
They will absolutely. But nobody cares at the end of the day from the business standpoint. They're looking at who's generating the income. They're looking at the largest group of people that are affecting the books.
Yeah, and I guess you can always adjust your marketing plans if you had to. Like, it's not going to, like... There are ways.
I mean, in the early days of indie authors, you know, when I wanted to avoid buying books that were indie published because, you know, at the beginning, a lot of them were low quality. You could tell, you know, because you could look at the publisher. That was always a giveaway. A lot of times they were only ebooks, and then they became only ebooks and only paperback because they could do that through Amazon. If you look at an AI generated title, it's the exact same thing now. You see, it's only an ebook. It may have a paperback. It's not going to have a hardcover. It's not going to have an audiobook. There's not going to be foreign translations for sure. So like if you do a little bit of detective work, you can always tell.
Well, I guess we should talk about our interview. JD, who's up this week?
This week, we've got Shannon Chakraborty coming on. She's a New York Times bestselling author of the Dababad trilogy, and she's been nominated for numerous awards, including the Hugo and Locus. Her latest novel is called The Tapestry of Fate and releases May 12th. Here she is.
Here we go. Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm very excited to talk to you. Big fan of Amina, as we will get into. But before we get into your latest book, let's kind of go all the way back to the beginning. We like to start with your origin story. How did you get started writing?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think like virtually anybody else who's a bookworm, I've been a book lover since I was very, very young. I was always one of those kids who just would tearing through pages in the middle of the night. I could go to the library and just come back with an entire stack in my arms. So I've always been a reader, but I came to writing a little late. Yes and no, a little late in its slightly different way. I would write fan fiction when I was a teenager.
Perfect.
That was what I was really into, you know, all of my millennial niches like Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Harry Potter, of course, and of Animorphs course. And all that. but I really just, writing was not anything I took seriously as a career. I'm from a working class family. I was the first to go to college, and I was far more focused on sort of like a serious career. You know, I was going to be a professor. I was going to work for the government. And I graduated into the recession, and suddenly all my career plans, graduate school were sort of off. And I was working at a medical office, and essentially just to kind of keep my mind busy, I started writing these stories set in a fantastical version of the medieval Islamic world. That was the period of history that I'd been studying, that I wanted to go back to graduate school to pursue, further study in and eventually teach one day. And I started writing this story, envisioning the fantasy world of the djinn and all their politics and their cities and their, you know, their conflicts. And it ended up turning into the City of Brass over many years, and many friends and family members pushing me and saying, you should do this, you know, like, this is good, we're enjoying this. That's how I wrote my first trilogy. And I talk to people, other writers or other aspiring writers, and I'll often say, you know, I didn't really feel like until I was about 3 books in that I was like, okay, this is actually going quite well. Maybe this can work as a career.
Right. Yeah, it only takes, I have heard that actually quite a lot that, even people who have more than three, have a string of successful books. Every one they're like, "Well, that was a good time." I like how it's always interesting they say your first novel takes like 10 years and then, your second, your third. And your novels have continued to be quite ambitious in not just the scope of the worlds, but sort of the intermingling of history and all of that. So how did you in the beginning, and then how has it changed track? Do you outline? How do you sort of tackle that, and has that changed the more books you publish?
It's changed. I think I had a very, very, I don't want to use the word brutal, but slightly brutal, sort of introduction to becoming a published author. I am one of those people that my first book took me 10 years to write. And then you're faced with, okay, can you write your next book in a year? Like, that's what
Right.
publishers and readers really want. They want about a book a year. And when you're first publishing, you feel just so lucky and so fortunate to be there, to have readers, to have a publisher willing to take a chance on you. You want to do everything you can.
Yeah.
So I sort of broke myself mentally and
Oh,
physically
no.
attempting to write The Kingdom of Copper. And even with The Empire of Gold, which is the third book I wrote and the final book in the David Bond trilogy, I was working and writing and researching at a really, really just punishing rate. I have, I'm a working mother as well. I had one daughter then, I have two now, and it was just not sustainable. And I first started it sort of I finished the trilogy. The last book came out in just the maybe the second month of the pandemic, and I could not work on anything else. I was supposed to write another book. I had the first Amina book already on contract. And the world was falling apart, right? So
Right, yeah.
I was trying to, I was trying to do virtual kindergarten, which is a phrase I never want to say again.
Wow.
My husband is a physician, so he was working in the throes of this, and it was a very difficult time. And I sort of had a wake up call that I could not continue working at the pace that I was working. And even though I had that wake up call, it still took me a few years to really internalize. So now I do not write a book a year. My goal is to write a book every or to finish take basically take 2 years to write a book. I have a larger gap between the first and second Amina books because I had a child and a very difficult postpartum recovery while that was happening. And I've sort of just made peace with that. I take my time to research, I take my time to write. I try to get the books out efficiently, but I'm no longer sort of, breaking myself doing all of the other stuff I have during the day and then also hitting the computer in the middle of the night to get words in. That's not, I'm 40 years old. That's not the pace I can do anymore. And in that, my process itself has changed. I used to just sort of, panic and want to outline and want to understand everything. And
Yeah.
I've come to understand I'm far more somebody who just needs to throw just an utter trash draft out on the screen that and that I can fix that during edits, that it's okay to sit down at the computer and just vibe with that first draft, write what I'm trying to write, maybe try a couple different character perspectives, but to really trust the process of just throwing it all out there, then going back and really seeing, okay, where is the story here? Where are the character beats? What needs to be fixed? And then outlining from that actually.
I love that actually, the coming to peace with it, but also just the vi draft vibing. We're gonna make that a thing now. That's gonna be a thing.
I think you get more, at least everyone has their own way of writing, right? There's no rules
Yeah.
here. Some people write great outlines and they knock it out right off the mark. Other people like me, we talk about, are we pantsers? Are we gardeners?
Yeah.
Personally, the way I feel for my own stories, I get more organic character growth and plot direction when I do sit with, well, what would feel natural here, not necessarily what does my outline say?
Yeah, I really like that, to trust yourself and know yourself. So you were studying, when you had kind of come up with the idea of City of Brass. So, 3 books later, where did the idea for your brash woman pirate Amina Al-Sarafi come from?
So, ironically enough, I joke that David Baud was historically inspired, and that when I wrote Amin al-Sarafi, I wanted it to be as historically realistic and plausible as possible, right? This was taking place in our world with 11th century technology and terms and people and all this history. Ironically enough, I also wrote a demon into the story that preys on those who are overly ambitious. And I'm sure these two things have nothing to do with
Completely
each other.
unrelated.
Completely unrelated. But I started drafting Amina and thinking of the character when I was querying City of Brass and it was going nowhere. And I
Oh,
felt like
interesting.
I was taking all this time from my family, that I just had a lot of working mother guilt. And that's something that I think a lot of parents have, right? We put so much pressure on parents of this generation you have to have the career, frankly, to just survive in this day and age, but you have to be the most present parent. And there's all like, it's an impossible burden, I think, for people to have, right? This is something we talk about all the time. And I really wanted to have a character that resonated with that. In so many historical tales and fantasy tales, 90% of them have to do with youth. That's the only, you're 18, and once you fall in love, or once you get married, or once you have a child, your adventures end. I hate to think of the fact that our adventures end, right? Our adventures never end. So I wanted a character who was not only a parent and dealing with all of the difficulties and joys of that, but someone who was older. To me, it felt like there was so much richness in writing a character who was middle-aged. You have so much more responsibility at that age, right? You have responsibilities for your community, for your family, for your kids, for your parents. There's just so much richness and more you can do with that. I think there's a lot more character moments and character beats you can play with. And I also, when I was writing the story, I love the medieval Islamic world, right? I love, and so much of what we know comes from travelers and scholars, and it was so wonderful of them to write down all these details so people like me could read and study it centuries later. At the same time, this is what we say about the past, right? The past is written by the privileged few. It's written by the victors. It's written by scholars, by privileged men, by those who are wealthy. And very often, when they were traveling through these parts of the world, they kind of looked down upon women, or the working class, the sailors who carried them all over the world. And I wanted to write a character that sort of spoke to how those people are often portrayed, how women are portrayed, how supposed witches, criminals, all of these people have been sort of castigated. Where is their legend? Where is the lie? I wanted a character that really brought all that together. So that was sort of how I conceived of Amina. And when I was thinking about it, I wanted it to, at the same time, to be an adventure tale, to be joyous, to be exciting, to hit many of the beats we know. I had originally pitched it as Sinbad the Sailor meets Ocean's 11, and my publisher heard that, and they were like, "You're
Done.
good. That's all we need." So I wanted it to feel joyous and fun at the same time.
Yeah, well, that definitely comes through all of those different things in the first one, and even a little bit amplified, I would say, in the second one. And I like the historical context. One thing you did that was really interesting, and I was trying to think if I've seen it, and I don't know that it comes up as often, but the magical artifact, you didn't pick something fantastical, you picked something very mundane. Why a spindle?
So when I first started thinking about what are the transgressions, these magical artifacts that Amina's going to have to retrieve, of course, I'm a fantasy writer. My first thought went to magical swords, magical books, all these sorts of really, truly amazing, fantastical items. And just, I don't even know how it came across my radar, but I was listening to an audiobook about the history of textile production, because this is what you do when you're postpartum and slowly losing your mind. And there was a line that stood out to me. They were talking about women's work, about how women's work is often overlooked. And there was a line, I think an anthropologist had come up with it, about what does it mean for women's work? Well, they're tasks that usually don't take you too far from the home, aren't too dangerous, and can be easily interrupted by the constant needs of small children. And I heard this in the audiobook and I laughed. And I think I actually paused it and told my husband, and then we were almost certainly interrupted by a small child. But it really just got me listening more about textile history and really appreciating just how much work this would have been for all of human history, and the like, everything from your clothes to the sails that we use on our boats to our nets, all of these items that we require for our life, for our civilization, the work they would have done, right? There's first the act of growing the crops or tending the animals, then shearing it, then producing it, spinning it, weaving it. And I thought that was fascinating. And there was also sort of an anecdote I was reading about just slavery on a much darker note, and just like the way that many of these, the people who produced these items were then often enslaved, stolen away. And I thought to myself, there is a lot going on here, right? This, the whole trilogy is about sort of the reclamation of women's voices, about how women are what we say and what we do, and their history is often unappreciated. And to me, this seemed like a perfect artifact to show that, because it also has to do with story, right? It's such a rich metaphor. We spin our tales, we weave our fates. I don't think it's a coincidence that we see this motif come up again and again in different cultural aspects. So that's how I was, once that started coming together, I was like, ah, this is perfect. It will let me introduce a female antagonist, which I wanted to do as well, and just really have a different look at a different kind of woman and archetype in this story.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it worked really well as far as just adding a lot of layers and threads to, you know, there's quite a lot going on in your story. What was the trickiest part, do you think, of this book? Felt just a little bit more complex than the first one. Not that the first one wasn't, but the first one kind of felt more straightforward. And this one, you know, had you know, friendship and betrayal and just all these other aspects to it. Maybe even a little hint to Odysseus as well.
Yes.
So how tricky was that, kind of pulling all that together and not going too far, you know, off the beaten path, I suppose.
I mean, the trickiest aspect, it was something that I feel like if I talk about it, it will ruin the story. So I won't say that. But I will say something that was tricky, but something that I really, really enjoyed, is I was having a hard time wrapping my head around how I wanted to present the antagonist. And I ended up just writing out her whole story, right? This is, it's again, I don't want to spoil too much, but it's meant to see a very large breadth of history, far larger than anything else I've done in my work. And I wanted to find different ways to show that and approach that. And finally, I was coming to a point, I was having a really hard time drafting this novel. Like I said, I wrote this postpartum and trying to come back from maternity leave and getting constantly interrupted. And just in a very difficult time of trying to keep all the threads of the story in my head. And I had a lot of different feelings on how I wanted to present this character. And finally, I just said, writing it out. And I just wrote out her entire story. It was about 30,000 words. But wow. Once I had that, everything clicked. And I was able to use some of it in this book. But it was, again, one of those lessons that I thought to myself, okay, for me personally, when I get stuck writing, sometimes I really just need to go write a scene or a character that I know is not going into the book, but it will help me reframe what I want to do with this story.
Yeah. Do you ever use those pieces, you know, in other ways? Do they come out in bonus chapters, or, you know, maybe there will be a collection of short stories in the future?
So something. I do have just that for Devabod, because we have a short story collection, The River of Silver, where I pulled together a lot of those chapters and those excerpts. I don't know if we'll do that for Amina. I did, like I said, I did use some of it in the novel, because then I thought it would be a very interesting, different perspective to get. I have a couple drafted for the third book. I don't know that all of them will be used, but I mean, I'll probably share them online or something one day. You know, my publisher's always asking, they're like, do you have any extra materials you can run in this edition? And I have to scroll through all of my microphones and see. I'm like, wait, I do think I remember being stuck and writing something new.
Do have that. So Amina, I don't know if I know this for sure. I'm assuming a trilogy.
Yes.
And then maybe a hint as to maybe what comes next.
So I don't have much more than a hint. I am I did make, you know, I sold two more books. They're going to be standalones to Harper Voyager that will, I will write them after I completely finish Amina. And there, I can say they will not be in sort of the Devabad Amina shared universe, which is meant to read as our universe. And we see some of the same characters and creatures show up. I do want to do something different. I want to sort of have a creative break. It'll still be historical fantasy. That's because that's what drives me. But I'm thinking probably a far older period. I've been really into both like the Bronze Age and antiquity, and been listening to far too many history books on the Neolithic era, and we'll see.
Fascinating. Well, I can't wait for that to come out. What surprised you the most while you were writing either this book or just the Amina trilogy in general?
Not so much surprised me, but just was very heartwarming is I get a lot of messages from other mothers, specifically a lot of other new mothers who are, you know, listening to the audiobook while nursing in the middle of the night or trying to kind of find their way back to making that balance. And that's really nice to hear because I wrote these books when I was struggling, when I still am, we're all struggling to find this balance. And I am really glad that this book does seem to resonate with parents.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that. It's very, even though Amina is off on these adventures, she is, you know, her daughter is very much top of her mind, no matter what. You know, this book is quite intense. I'm sitting here kind of thinking, you know, if someone postpartum, and then the subject matter that Amina went through, you know, how did you sort of emotionally balance, you know, writing this creative, darker story with what was going on in your personal life?
Probably not entirely well. Again, I don't want to spoil things, but Tapestry of Fate is definitely a darker book. I often will compare it to horror. Like I was looking for more of a horror element, but it was also diving into periods of history that are grimmer and more ghastly than anything I've done before. I mentioned writing the antagonist's point of view. It was probably the grimmest scene I've ever written. And I also felt like I love history, but a lot of human history is very dark. And it is full of suffering. We can try to find joy and adventure, but there's no getting around the fact that our civilizations are built on oppression and persecution and conquest. Another sort of terrible fact that I learned when doing the research for this book is that one of the earliest recorded words, I mean, in the earliest foundation of what would become writing, is the term for a female slave of foreign origin. And that just sort of took me aback, right? All of our literature, all of our grand civilization that is built around the written word, and it goes right back to the transaction of a stolen woman from a during war, during conquest. And that's something I think we have to settle with. A lot of history is the tale of great men, and we have this trite phrase, and you know, the men were killed and women and children enslaved. What does that mean to really sit with that and think about just the way so many of our ancestors would have gone through this? So I don't want history to just be portrayed as it's, you know, it's fun and it's not, it's neither both these things. It's not all terrible suffering and it's not pure escapism, but I wanted to sort of have this story sit with that fact and that history. And that was a difficult thing to write, right? You don't write scenes like that and then close the computer and go down and make dinner for your own daughters. And I don't have great answers for that. It's just sort of you can look in what's going on in our own world. That's just part. Humans seem to be capable of inflicting great suffering on each other. And I think we can't get away from that in the fiction we write all the time.
Yeah, well, I think that's true. And I would hope that it helps both the writer and the reader in some way sort of process and understand. Well, this has just been an absolute delight. You are lovely to talk to. I could spend all afternoon picking your brain on all kinds of interesting historical tidbits. But as we close, we like to ask everyone this last question. What's one piece of advice you would give to new or aspiring writers?
I will often tell people to just try to finish something, even if what they finish is absolute, you know, it's the draftiest draft that has ever been. I know from my own writing, I would get so worked up about like, I just have to get this scene and then I'll move on. You don't. You can just write, hey, this is what I want this scene to be, or I don't know where I want to go in the story, and then just try to move on. Just try to write things that you're excited about, somewhat piece them together, but try to get to something of an end point, because I find when you go back to look at it, overall, you tend to see where things need to fit and where you need to fix things. And I think it can be a big psychological relief to be done or at a finishing point, even if you know so much more needs to be fixed.
I love that. Yeah, I think that's right. Well, again, thank you so much for joining us today. Everyone, if you like incredible women and interesting adventure, you should pick up the Amina Al-Sarafi series.
Oh, thank you.
So this book is a lot of fun, and I thought it was really interesting that her magical artifact was just a normal spindle. So I don't know if you've used that, but or if you would, but what household item would you pick or have you picked that makes it interesting to your plot?
I in my Sawyer Jackson trilogy, one of the characters uses buttons, like coat buttons or shirt buttons, to open open reality so I can step from one universe into another.
I knew you would have something, Kevin. I knew it.
That's not even the only one. I had a magic floating eight ball that was actually the sum total of all knowledge in the universe. So
I've never done that because I don't write so much fantasy, but maybe I just do like a chewed up pen. That'd be fantastic.
Yeah. It would have to be something weird like that.
And
the closest I've got a short story about a girl who's got a diary, and anything she writes in the diary actually happens. So she's like, she's writing it now, but then it happens tomorrow kind of thing. But yeah,
fun.
I think to go that route, you'd have to pick something, you know, like I'm looking around my office and there's nothing worthwhile in my office.
My poster.
Yeah.
Yeah. A chapstick.
Stephen King wrote a short story about a magical pink Kindle.
Really?
Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
Posted on KU.
Fake mustache? I could just pick things up on my desk.
I think he did one about the chair in a hotel room, too, at one point, right? You know, like every hotel room has that chair in the corner that nobody really sits in.
Oh, that's
And if I remember right in this story, anybody that sits in it dies.
Chair.
Oh, dies.
If someone's...
I feel like, but those like little things, I mean, you could do that with a thriller, like make the clue. I mean, I feel like they probably do that, just something like really mundane, and you know, it's a chewed up pen cap that gives it away. I don't know, something that
the grocery list.
That's a very Sherlock Holmes kind of thing. Like, you know, the chewed up pen cap was the clue that broke the case open. Very Holmes.
Now I'm picturing Nazis in that giant warehouse from Raiders of the Lost Ark opening a giant case with another box inside, and then when they finally open the last one, all it is a chewed up ball cap pen cap.
Perfection.
Yep.
Russian nesting dolls.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also thought it was really funny how she called her process draft vibing.
Draft vibing.
I thought that was really fun.
I like that.
Yeah, Kevin, you draft vibe. JD,
I
would you ever
vibe.
Draft vibe?
Probably not.
No. You used to. You were a pantser back in the day.
Is that draft vibing?
Yeah.
I'd call that draft vibing.
Then I have totally draft vibed.
Yeah.
See? We're all part of the cool kids.
I have draft vibed. I have, yeah.
Yeah. I thought something else that was really, I feel like thrillers, because she was talking about where the character came from and sort of like wanting to do the, you know, the mom and kind of step away from like that young plucky hero. I feel like thrillers sort of do this, like the grizzled detective is pretty common. But do you guys ever think about like when you're creating characters, like how to, I guess, break away from the norm? Or do you try to kind of stick with reader expectations a little bit more?
I think those norms get dangerous. Like when I was writing The Fourth Monkey, initially Sam Porter, I gave him an alcohol problem. And like, I didn't realize just how many detectives had alcohol problems. You know, so I stripped that whole thing out of there. So like when you start falling back on those tropes, a lot of times it's going
to
hurt you.
No, yeah, it's cool to subvert tropes. Now I'm thinking like Legally Blonde. I'm just going to write like a... I don't know.
Elle Woods.
Yeah.
What, like it's hard?
It's like you're a detective.
All my detectives chew on pen caps.
Yeah, exactly.
We should name this episode the Chewed Up Pen Cap.
The okay. Chewed Up Pen Cap.
The Curious the Dan Case Cutler of thriller. The Chewed Up Pen Cap.
I love it. I have to write that now.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. I just realized, like, we're time up. So, JD, who's up next week?
Next week, we've got Laurie Foster coming on. Laurie is a New York Times and USA Today bestselling author of sexy contemporary romance novels, and she sold over 10 million copies worldwide. Her latest novel, The Lake House, releases May 26th, and she's going to be here to tell us all about it. Laurie Foster.
Yeah, it's going to be great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.